Ladies and gentlemen, if you will please reconvene, rush over to get that last cup of coffee if you're still looking to get a cup of coffee at this point. This is the time to do it. Will you please join me in thanking the hotel staff who have been phenomenal? We are so grateful. And our Cracker Jack AV team who have prevented you from becoming aware of any of the disasters that occur backstage in an event of this kind. If you have any difficulty seeing from where you are, please feel free to scoot your chair over. This is a gorgeous, historic building, and I love being in it. It's a wonderful environment to share our time together in. But these older buildings do have a few quirks. I understand that one of the colloquia was in the meat locker and the other colloquia was in the sauna, and the rooms were right next to each other. But that's all right. We all seem to have survived. Perseverance to the end is a theological theme, so we're grateful for your being with us. And this gorgeous building really is a blessing to us, and we appreciate it. My name is Greg Forster, and I am the director of the Oikonomia Network. The Oikonomia Network was founded in 2010 as a network of evangelical theological schools and educators. We've grown since then, and we're richly blessed to have the community that we serve in. We have 21 partner schools who are the core constituency of the Oikonomia Network. We also have quite a few individual scholars who are affiliated with us and partner organizations like the Chalmers Center and all sorts of other partners who we're very blessed, the Theology of Work Project and Made to Flourish, that we're very blessed to work with. We have, as I mentioned, several different events that are coming together today. We have our first ever scholarly colloquia, and you'll be hearing a little more from some representatives of those colloquia. We have a theological colloquium meeting, we have a biblical studies colloquium meeting, and we have a historical colloquium meeting. And these are small groups of scholars who have written papers on topics related to the Oikonomia Network's areas of interest. And they have been meeting today, and they'll continue meeting tomorrow to discuss their papers. And we're very excited to be of service to the community and to make new friends and start new conversations through these colloquia. And we're very grateful to the folks who have organized those colloquia. Mike Thigpen, who organized the biblical colloquium, David Bouchard, who organized the theological colloquium, and Nathan Hitchcock, who organized the historical colloquium. They have done phenomenal work and put in a lot of hours, and we're very grateful to them. Also present is our faculty retreat. Every year since 2013, the Oikonomia Network has had an annual faculty retreat for our most involved leaders. At that inaugural retreat, we were richly blessed to have Dallas Willard speak to us. He gave two full-length lectures on economics. So if you're interested in Dallas Willard on economics, and if you're not, shame on you. If you're interested in Dallas Willard on economics, you can get those audio files for free on our website, as well as files of the many other leading people who have spoken at our retreat. We've been blessed to have leaders in theological education, including Bob Cooley, Dan Aylshire, Greg Jones. We've also had some very important voices from the broader church, including Amy Sherman, Paul Williams, and last year, Brian Fickert, who gave a real barn burner of a talk about the narratives, the secular narratives taking over economic spaces. Speaking of which, we wanted to give out copies of Brian Fickert's latest book at last year's retreat, but the book was not out yet. So we're playing catch up this year. We're giving you a copy of Brian Fickert's latest book. He's the third name. It's, if you put on your glasses or your magnifying glass here, you can see that it is a Brian Fickert book here on the bottom. And since we knew we would have the colloquia with us, we splurged and have extra copies. So those of you who are here with us from the colloquium, just consider this our gift to you for being with us. We're grateful. We're grateful for your being here. Unfortunately, Brian Fickert has thwarted our effort to catch up with him, because while we are giving you last year's Brian Fickert book, he has a new book that's coming out this year. So we're caught up for the moment, but not for long. It's called Becoming Whole, and it's a really good effort. It's sort of a return to theological basics for Brian, and it's an exciting event. So watch for the release of that book coming later this year. Well, it is great to be back with you. Those of you who have been with us many times before, it's wonderful to reconnect. The faculty retreat is an opportunity for us to gather away from the demands of the tyranny of the urgent that commands our attention. And as I've said many times in the past, as we're carrying forward this mission to bring new themes or to increase the presence of these themes in theological education, we spend a lot of our times covering the same ground over and over again, sort of naming the issue of how we have accepted a dualism between church stuff and work stuff. And helping people to come to see the way they have a pair of glasses on that caused that divide to occur even before they're aware of it, because we're reading the Bible and we're reading the world around us with those polarized glasses that make things look like they're separate even before we're aware of it. And these basic insights about how God cares about work and how work is a central theme in the Bible that runs all the way from Genesis to Revelation and is part of the deep pattern of the meta-narratives of Scripture. These basic ideas we have to continue coming back to and back to. And it can, you know, after a while you begin to wonder, you know, have I given my life to just sort of reciting the same six talking points over and over again? So one of the wonderful things about the faculty retreat is it's an opportunity to come together and step back from the tyranny of the urgent and spend time together not only reconnecting with colleagues and friends and meeting new colleagues and friends, but also a time to think about the big picture issues, to think about what are the big picture things that are happening, what are the new ideas we need to be thinking about, or renewed ideas that we need to be thinking about, what are the resources, the deep resources in our theological traditions that we can be drawing on, what's going on in the world around us that impacts theological education and that we need to be thinking about. So the faculty retreat has always been an opportunity to think big. And of course, the colloquia are intended to be an opportunity to think big. So it's a wonderful chance to come together tonight with all of these groups and think together. To begin our time together, we will have an address from Miroslav Volf of Yale University. He will get a longer and more elaborate introduction tomorrow at our much bigger event, Quorum Forum, and I don't want to steal the thunder of my colleague who will be introducing him tomorrow and who will have much more to say, but it's a name very familiar to you, and we've been grateful for his work in a number of different areas of theology over the years. I want to quickly mention some logistical things while I have everyone's undivided attention before we begin the program and then scatter to the four winds. Regardless of which event you are here for, breakfast tomorrow is in the Landmark Restaurant, which is down at the other wing of the hotel. So if you go back down that corridor and keep going past where the main desk is, that's where breakfast will be available. Those of you who are with the colloquia, you have your schedule for reconvening in the space where you were before. If you are with the faculty retreat tomorrow after breakfast, please come back to the main entrance where we will have shuttles. We'll all be going over to Park City's Presbyterian Church, which is a nearby church. It's just a mile down the road, and it has a thriving faith and work ministry. And we're going to be having the rest of our faculty retreat meetings over in that space, which is a wonderful incarnational opportunity to be present in a place where the work that God is doing in the faith and work movement is really getting grounded in the local church and the local church's ministry to its people. So we're really grateful to Park City's Presbyterian Church for their hospitality in bringing us in. So that's the plan for tomorrow morning. And if you're at the retreat, what's the time for the buses? I'm afraid I've left my piece of paper back in my seat. Sorry? 8 to 8:30, the shuttles are running back and forth. So get there at 8 to be bright and early so we can run those shuttles. But between 8 and 8:30, we'll be running shuttles back and forth to the church. Thank you. All right, without further ado, I'm going to introduce Miroslav Volf come and give us an address. He'll be speaking on the unity of the theological disciplines, and I'll allow him to frame his talk further. And then after he speaks, we'll have a panel discussion with some other representatives of our colloquia, and then we'll have a Q&A with everybody. So without further ado, Miroslav Volf.
Good evening, friends. I see that some of you are properly dressed here, and my mother gave me instructions that every time I appear somewhere, I ought to be at least slightly overdressed and never underdressed. So I feel that I'm letting down my mother. speaking to you in jeans and sneakers. But we're in Texas, right? So I've got a belt, at least belt is right, right? okay. So I would like to talk to you about theology and how theology does or does not take up some of the issues that are central, I know, to your own concern. One of the topics that we are discussing, at least in the theology section of which I'm a part, is the question of flourishing, or I would say the question of the good life, or you can put it differently, the question of the true life, or you can put it the question of the life that is truly worth living, a life that is truly life. You have a variety of terms that have been used to describe that which we as human beings ought to aspire to realize in our individual and also in our communal generally human lives. Now, I personally think, and the argument that I make in the book that has been just released by Brazos, is that theology ought to be about discerning, articulating, and commending a vision of flourishing life informed by God's revelation, self-revelation, in Jesus Christ. So you see, the purpose of theology, as I've sketched it, that it is centered around flourishing life. Now, that's going to be very controversial. We can discuss some of these things also later, and I'll talk tomorrow in the morning, certainly, about this. But one of the reasons why I stress this is because I do believe that that's what theology truly was from the beginning about, because that's what I think Christian faith is about. That's what Jesus Christ was about. That's what Apostle Paul was about. That's what, in one way or another, Christian faith and Christian theologians over century were about. And yet, somehow, I think that at least academic theology has forgotten that purpose and finds itself today in a crisis. Now, it's a particularly unfortunate time to find yourself as a theologian in this particular kind of crisis. The reason is that actually in the wider culture, indeed, it's a feature of modern societies as a whole, that we have gradually lost ability to speak in an articulate way, or even to have the question of the good, about the question of the good life, or even to have that question of the good life profoundly matter to us. So, most of you are familiar with various philosophers, sociologists have analyzed the issue, is that we have lost ability to think of the good as a common project. We have privatized the vision of the good. Most famous person articulating this was in the 70s, Alistair MacIntyre. We have privatized the good. And not only that we have privatized the good in the sense that the good has become something that each of us on our own has to decide about, but we have made the question of good a matter of taste in some ways. You can see it very clearly expressed in the advice that we often give to our children when they ask us, well, how should we live? What should we do? And then we are really smart. We want to give them really wise advice. We talk to them about their school, about being good persons. But, And then they got big but, and then we say what matters the most. But make sure that you follow your dream. Now, this following of my dream is the almost defining feature of what we perceived to be a successful, a good life. It's your dream, and that dream ought to somehow reflect who you are deep down in your own self. You're as authentic, articulate to your dream as you are have been by putting your baseball cap backwards, right? You kind of end up reflecting what everybody else thinks is a kind of dream worth pursuing, but it somehow has to be authentically yours. And it matters that it is authentically yours. Now, the consequence of that was that we have lost, that most of our great institutions in our society have become primarily about gathering or creating resources so that each one of us, in changing circumstances, can live the good life as they see fit. So the major institutions end up being about creation of resources so that I can pursue my own private good. That's what economy is about, creation of means for most people, creation of means so that I can deploy them, I can have money, financial capital to live a good life. That's what our education is about, because I have need to have educational capital. I need to have certain reputational capital, variety of forms of capital. I'm using capital here in a positive sense of the term, that you need in order to be able to realize your dream, your private dream. And so we end up spending most of our time trying to create resources for life that we hardly ever end up living. What happens actually is that, well, the picture that one sociologist uses, Hartmut Rosa, who's written about that topic, German sociologist, he says, well, we're like a painter who is obsessing about his studio, about how the life falls in, what kind of easel, what do you call it, easel?
Easel.
I'm almost saying in German, donkey in German, right? Easel, he or she has brushes and fusses everything about the studio that he or she never ends up doing any painting. And part of the reason for that is that creation of resources often end up morphing from being a means to something to being an end that we pursue. And if we are successful, we measure ourselves how well we have succeeded in creating resources for life that we aren't living. And we have lost in the process ability to even reflect about what the good life might be, what abiding vision of what the good life is. Now, against the backdrop of this, I am suggesting that we develop a theological endeavor that places this question at the heart of our theological search, all different theological disciplines. But my suggestion comes at the time when theology, academic theology, is somehow highly unlikely to do just that, to provide the resources for which it is uniquely qualified to speak, about which it is uniquely qualified to speak. Now, why do I say this, that theology is incapable addressing what I think is one of the great questions of our time? I think it's incapable of doing so because theology is in a deep crisis. Now, before I sketch for you the crisis of theology, let me state very clearly that I'm a very happy theologian. That is, or I'm very happy about being a theologian, and therefore I'm also a very happy theologian. I knew that I'm going to be a theologian when I was 16. And from 16, I'm 62 now, 46 years, I do not recall a single day, a single moment, where I have regretted being a theologian. I don't regret it even when I sit with some of my friends who are in business or in other areas where they sip this $300 wine, so they have private jets that they can fly in. And I still think it was a good thing for me to be a theologian, not because this is the most important thing, not because this is more important thing than what my friends are doing, but because this is a calling that I have received from God, and that has something important to say about our life in the world today. And by the way, since we are here, a multidisciplinary group, I want to say also that I never quite knew where I fit in the theological spectrum of theological disciplines. My first publication was the New Testament, and I continued to engage scriptures. I'm least at home in historical theology. Other theological disciplines, all of them somehow find their way into my work, and I think partly because I think that we need the unity of theological disciplines. One of the problems is the splintering of theology into a variety of disciplines. So let me say a few words about this crisis of theology. And I have, in this book, For the Life of the World, I have divided them into external crisis and internal crisis. And I should say immediately that external crisis is a crisis that we feel, but internal crisis is much more important. External crisis. Well, seminaries are closing, right? Places where we used to work are fewer and fewer around. There is a scarcity of work for theologians. We see that when our students graduate with PhDs, it's hard to find a place to work, whether in seminary, whether that's in Christian colleges, or whether that is in the university divinity schools. If you have two or three young theologians talking together in an animated way, you're about 95% sure that they're going to be talking how they can't find a job. And they've spent quite a bit of time, invested a lot of time in studying for a job that they cannot find, and even if they find it, it pays not particularly well. Now, there's a loss not just of jobs, but there's a loss of audience. It used to be that lay people used to read some, at least, of theology. I don't think very many lay people today read a work by academic theologians. I just want to make sure that some of you are maybe pastors. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about us. I'm talking about academic theologians, right? There is a good deal of good theology that's being written and read, but academic theology is not among the disciplines doing the writing. Audience has been pretty much all lost. Clergy does not read much of theological work. If you look at the publishers, what they publish in Germany, about 100 million German-speaking folks, a theological book by a university professor will be published in 400 copies. If you come to English-speaking world, 360 million English language speakers, if a first run of the book is 1,500 copies, that's a good run. 1,500 copies may not sell, right? So you might say, well, are then theologians writing for theologians, right? We live in the age of specialization, so maybe that's what's going on. Well, if you ask that question, then I don't see too many theologians reading work of other theologians. I sometimes feel that theologians are reading more secular thinkers than they are reading kind of Christian theological thinkers, that they're reading more Instagram, Facebook or other mass media, social media sources of information that they're reading actually serious theological, academic theological work. And then it's not just that the reason why an audience is lost is not because theologians don't know simply how to write in a popular way. That's true too. And it helps if when theologians write more in a popular way. But the problem is that reputation of theologians has plummeted. When I fly and people ask me, what do? I don't answer to them, I'm a theologian. And because if I answer I'm a theologian, they're going to kind of shrug their shoulders. They wouldn't know quite what to do with this. But I'll tell them that I ponder the deep questions of life, you know, give them an example. And suddenly, if I want a conversation, I'll have one, no problem. Because theology still speaks to fundamental issues of which people are interested, but they don't particularly appreciate theologians speaking about it. I remember talking with Larry Summers, who was at that time president of Harvard. And they were, Harvard University was searching for a dean. And he looked me in the eyes and said, you know, Miroslav, if Harvard were founded today, if he were founding Harvard today, it would not have a divinity school. You have Queen of Sciences, we thought, right? Who is now banished, and in some of those institutions where it still remains, is somewhere there in the corner, like an embarrassing uncle, that when the occasion comes, you will show him, but otherwise you won't let him meander in your dwelling places in order to spoil the good party that you are having. All right. So that's the external crisis, I think, of theology, and many of us feel it. I've obviously exaggerated some. For the purpose of this after dinner talk, it's more expressed in a more nuanced way in the text that I've published. So you end up doing you end up thinking, well, theologians are these people who write about abstruse topics that are of interest to nobody else. Why be a theologian? That's the impression from outside. But I think internal crisis is more important. Academic theology could weather its external crisis if it were not for serious illness that affects its own body. Theology, I think, is a vocation. It does not depend on external validation. It has its own justification in the call of God and the service to the world. After all, Apostle Paul was the first, and in my judgment, the greatest of all theologians. Wasn't particularly influential in Roman Empire when he started writing, right? So that's not an influence so much, or reputation so much. It's not so much of a problem. Just a story that concerns me and has to do with reputation. After I graduated from Tübingen and I was a student of Jürgen Moltmann, I went to Croatia, and for about 7 years, I was teaching theology in a very small Pentecostal college, Bible school, basically, a seminary in Croatia. And I didn't regret teaching theology, but I complained. I complained to Moltmann and said, "Yeah, why do I have to teach here? You know, look, I'm in this place, nobody's interested in what I'm trying to do. When the weekend comes, I have to go and preach to 15 old ladies and get the chicken as a little gift, or something of that." I said, "You know, Jürgen." I'm complaining to, and then Jürgen says to me, "You know, Miroslav, a place does not make a theologian. A theologian makes a place." Thank you, Jürgen. I wasn't so sure that I understood, that I appreciated his lack of sympathy with my complaint, but he was absolutely right. Wittenberg was nothing before Luther came around, and then became suddenly the center of the theological thought and controversy at the time Luther was alive. So reputation, neither here nor there, if we are after what we should be after. But are we theologians about articulating, discerning, articulating, and commending a vision of true life based in the revelation, self-revelation of God in Jesus Christ? Well, some of us are. But when I survey the great landscape of theology, I see at least two great temptations, by the way, which are not temptation of only quote-unquote liberals, but the temptations of evangelicals as well. I see it just about everywhere. And first of them is to treat theology as a science. It's a kind of quasi-science, almost, I would want to say. That's based on the research ideal that is at the foundation of the modern university, and it has garnered a great reputation, obviously, because rooted in natural methodologies of natural sciences, great research ideal was incremental increase in knowledge. And this incremental increase in knowledge has had a tremendously transformative power, right? Who wouldn't be impressed by New Horizon passing by Ultima Thule, right? And sending us photos and theology, what does theology have to show for itself? Nothing comparable to anything of that. Most then disciplines in the universities have tried to somehow adjust themselves to be more methodologically in line with natural sciences, with a certain distance depending on the subject matter that they are studying. Theologians as well. And so theologians have become engaged in descriptive activity. They are historians, primarily. If they're practical theologians, they tend to be sociologists then. And the entire effort is to describe the state of affairs. But when theology, when that happens, obviously, then the subject matter of theology is not the true life or commending a vision of the true life. It's not God. It's not redemption. It's not the true life. What the subject of matter is description of Christianity in its various forms. Now, I personally have nothing against the descriptive work that theology does. It's a very important and fundamental work. But it cannot be the heart of what theology does. When theology does that, very often what happens is that we lose the unity of theological subject matter. And part of the reason why I can decide whether I want to be a biblical scholar or a systematic theologian or philosopher or ethicist or practical theologian because I believe that these disciplines belong together. In research ideal, splinters that knowledge very often. And then as scientists, of course, if you're a scientist, we can't talk about normative questions. We can describe. But we can't engage in a normative way with issues. And obviously, then we become, to the extent that people are interested in Christianity, we are interesting. To the extent that they're not, we're not. Think of New Testament scholars. Some of you are New Testament scholars. Unless biblical texts matter for us today, why are we studying them? It's kind of studying exotic plants. It's not a particularly compelling as literature. It's just marginal group of people, uneducated, fumbling through ways of expressing themselves, writing about some failed preacher who got himself crucified, and his believers, those who followed him, started believing that he was actually a Messiah. If that doesn't matter for us today, we're going to become irrelevant. A study of it is going to become irrelevant. Now, so that's if we are kind of see ourselves as some of those us who see ourselves as scientists. But there are a lot of us who are engaged in normative endeavor. But what happens then if you're of a conservative bent? Well, we tend to repeat the formulas from the past, as if by repeating them and repeating them in a particular way, they're going to be more plausible than they otherwise were. Contribution that we have to make is relatively minimal. If we are more of progressive kind, well, what do? We take the basic convictions of, broad convictions of our culture, which are that we want to remove limits to our freedom, we want to fight exclusion, and we want to mitigate suffering, and we make it our own project. We then just say, I would put it this way, in a religious voice, what others are saying in their own language. Or I can put it this way, what other critics, social critics, are saying in perfectly fine Oxford English, we are stuttering in our churchy vocabularies to say exactly the same thing. By the way, that's why I have decided to become Episcopalian. Nothing to do, right? You see, what's the relationship between the two? Well, because when I came to a number of churches, whether they're more conservative or evangelical or more progressive, people were analyzing me. If I went into more evangelical churches, they would be kind of Dr. Phil to me. And then they would psychologize me, give me little petty advice that they have garnered from reading some pop psychology. And I say, why am I sitting here being analyzed? Or if I went to more progressive churches, they were like Chomsky to me. They were kind of wagging the moralizing finger at me. Why am I not doing this? I can read Chomsky back at home. I can read social analysis much better back at home, just like I can read much better psychology when I am back at home. What I need when I come to church is I need my life to be brought before God. I need to see myself in the light of God's revelation. I need to be challenged to transform my life, not somebody to wag finger at me, but for God's spirit to be present in me, open me up to what God calls me to do. Now, I think theology also ought to be about just that as well, rather than simply mirroring in our own religious idiom what others are saying in any case. Now, especially in today's time, we have become very hesitant to articulate positively a vision of the good life. I talked earlier about kind of difficulty in sketching a vision. We all have our personal dreams. But then the substitute for that becomes, once you start doing a kind of normative work, is to interrogate what's going on around us, to unmask, to trouble, to problematize, to expose, to subvert, to demystify, to destabilize, all these D prefixes, right, which are about removing something. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of things that are said that need to be removed actually do need to be removed. But here I ask you a question. How much theology do you need for that? How much theology do you need in order to be against obstacles to freedom? How much theology do you need to fight exclusion or to be against exclusion? How much theology do you need in order to mitigate suffering? Well, you need actually a lot if you want to properly define what freedom is, if you want to properly understand what modes of exclusion are, if you want to delve deeply into the nature of suffering. But if you simply echo sensibilities, you need a zero theology for that. And then no wonder that nobody listens to theologians when they speak. How significant is theology as academic discipline? You know, I ask myself this, I'll finish in about 5 minutes, less than five. I was toying with myself asking this question. I said, okay, so how much does it cost to educate a theologian? Well, at a place like Yale, postgraduate education of a single student through the PhD program has a price tag close to $1 million. So from master's through PhD, 6 years, PhD, 10 years of education, total price tag, not what a student pays, but what the university, everybody pays, around $1 million. On the average in the United States, a theologian earns about $90,000, benefits included. So add that 30 years of service, it's about $3 million. $4 million. For what are we spending $4 million? Educating me. Educating theologians. I think this is a very unsettling question to ask for theologians, but it's a very necessary question to ask, because it poses the question of what the purpose, what the good is, which we are seeking to achieve. Given the state of academic theology today, why does the world need million-dollar theological heads working on $93,000 a year? That's the question. Now, what's the answer to this question? Is there something that theology can contribute that other disciplines cannot? Is there something of fundamental importance that theology can contribute, but other disciplines cannot? I think for myself, and I would like to discuss that with you, I'm intentionally being provocative, for myself, the answer to this question is that theology addresses and seeks to discern, to articulate, to study the purposes of human existence, of our lives. Now, earlier I talked to you that the entirety of our social endeavor, almost entirety of it, is about means. I look at education at Yale that students get, any educational institution, it is about resources that they will deploy for whatever benefit of humanity there would be. But what use are the means if you don't know what the end is? And it's these ends that theology, that Christian faith, by the way, other faiths as well, and there's a kind of contestation that then happens between faiths, both secular and religious faiths. But the purposes of human life are absolutely fundamental to who we as human beings are. We lose the best of our humanity when we reduce ourselves to means producers. And that's why I think that theology profoundly matters. And if theology were to reorient itself and take up the great questions of human life, in the light of Jesus Christ. Christian theology will do it in the light of God's self-revelation in Jesus Christ. We might be able to contribute something that nobody else can. Sciences cannot. Sciences cannot answer the question of the purposes of our lives. They can describe. Imagine this. Google knows everything about you, or somebody knows everything possibly that is to be known about you. They can predict all sorts of things that you what you would do, right? We see that happening even now, right? But imagine something very sophisticated machine that knows you better than you know yourself. It knows what you desire. It knows what you want to desire but do not desire. But what it cannot know is what you ought to desire. That ought of my desire, it doesn't know what it means to be human. What is the content of true humanity? What I ought to aspire to be, or to put it in the Nietzschean terms, toward the end when he wrote his book, The Antichrist. Antichrist book starts with a few sentences into it. He asks the question, what kind of human beings should we breed? Well, forget about breeding, right? But think about the seriousness of the question. What kind of humans should we aspire to become? Should we aspire to become? The only way to answer that question, the only compelling way to answer that question, is by looking at, from my perspective, into the Christian tradition. But only way in which humanity has engaged that question over the centuries in enduring way is in religious mode of reflection. Again, there'll be contestation between various points. But that's what we need to highlight. And that's why we need theological education. That's why we need theological conversation. That's why we need to frame how our politics is organized, what our economy should be, how our education is, in the context of larger vision of purposes, God's purposes for our life. When that does not happen, we as theologians fail, we as humans fail. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We have some chairs and microphones coming up for our panel. Don't go far, we're coming right back. yes, definitely. I'd like to invite our panelists to come up and join us. If you'd make your way forward, we've got the chairs coming up. We've asked one person from each of our three colloquia to join us for a discussion of what we've just heard. And then while we're having the initial conversation up here, if you want to submit a question, go to slido.com on your device. And if you enter the code KF19, you'll get our page there, and there'll be a little box you can type in a question. And you can see everybody else's questions as they type them in, and you can vote for which questions you want to have answered, which is something we've been using that helps us find the best possible questions quickly that everybody wants answered. So feel free to go ahead and start doing that while we get started. I'd like to ask our panelists to come up. From the Biblical Colloquium, we have Lynn Kohick of Denver Seminary joining us. From the Theological Colloquium, we have Kelly Capick of Covenant College. And from the History Colloquium, Charlie Self of Assemblies of God Seminary. Come on up. Let's get situated here. And we should have microphones on the way. You know, when Miroslav was talking about how in evangelical churches he is treated like Dr. Phil, and then in progressive churches, treated like Noam Chomsky, I felt immediately an urge to say, well, I'd rather be Dr. Phil than Noam Chomsky. But of course, that's the wrong response, isn't it? I'm reminded of C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity talking about when he's describing extreme individualism and extreme collectivism. And he says, I feel a strong desire to tell you which is worse, but of course that's the devil getting at us. So in a moment, I will flagrantly abuse my position as moderator to ask a few provocative questions. But first, I want to give each of our panelists a chance to share their initial responses to what Miroslav has shared with us this evening. So I guess we'll go in order down the line. So go ahead.
Sure.
You're on the hot seat.
All right. Yeah, thank you so much. It's depressing. So thank you for that. but I think it is hopeful. In a sense, I actually don't think it's depressing because I think those of us in theology have seen this. And I think many of us have felt it, right? Even as you talk about your own narrative, most of us got into this because of vocation. The challenge is that along the way, something gets lost, I think. Because it's a very long, expensive, exhausting journey with, you know, not gold at the end of the rainbow. So you do have to, but part of what I was thinking as you were talking is George Marsden years ago wrote a little Oxford Press book called The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship. And I was thinking about similar problems where he talks about Christians who, you know, inspired by Mark Nolan, Marsden was involved with that, going off to study history and being really, I'm going to do this in a Christian way. And then by the time they were done with their PhDs, the only difference was they might pray at the beginning of class, right? And I remember thinking, I'm not so sure it's different for us as theologians, that so worried about piety, so worried about certain just legitimacy, feeling like, and we even physically feel it at our institutions, Yale, Princeton, Cambridge, Oxford, King's College, University of London, where I was at, often physically you are put in a different place, right? And so anyways, I thought about that, and I thought about my neighbor. You were saying you don't tell people you're a theologian, and years ago when I moved to my neighborhood in 2001, a neighbor I didn't know said, hey, you know, what do you do for a living? I said, I teach theology. And she said, there are beautiful rocks around here, aren't there? And I said, yes, there are. And we never talked about it again. So I think that's right.
Especially Apostle Peter.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't. So in a sense, as you know, what you're advocating for, if I'm understanding you rightly, is the Christian tradition. That is, I mean, the Reformers and others, the scholastic tradition of making a distinction between, you know, scientia practica and scientia speculativa. Like, we are a practical science. And I think even the ability to use language of science of us now is compromised because it means something very different in our day. I think I might see it a little different in the sense of maybe I'm a little more hopeful because my primary audience is undergraduates. And one of the great privileges I have is to watch students walk in on day one feeling like theology's a waste of my time, but I have to take this. And then and these are all different disciplines. They're biologists, law students, everyone, you know. And just watching the lights go on. Because, like I said, it's because this gives purpose to their life. And the joy is when they realize they don't have to become professional theologians, this still gives purpose. And so I do wonder what you're pushing us toward as theologians, those of us who are theologians, to maybe think more in terms of provoking the longings in listeners that they have and maybe don't realize they have. And I think when we relegate ourselves to simply description, which I think you're right, we undercut ourselves. Anyways, there are various thoughts, but that's something.
Thank you very much. Lynn?
Thank you, Miroslav, for a very provocative paper. I especially appreciated your challenge. Well, let me start a little bit earlier. You are always welcome to come back to your true home of New Testament studies. We will gladly receive you.
I occasionally make incursions.
Always welcome. I really appreciated your comment about presenting a vision of the good life. This was brought home even today, coming from the airport in an Uber. Myself and two of my colleagues were a captive audience to a very talkative Uber driver who had a seminary degree and got burned out in a church. I know a lot about his life, if you're interested. But one of the things that he mentioned just as we were pulling into the driveway here was that in his denomination, they had a conference a month or two ago in which many of them, 60%, 80% of those pastors, was that 80? 80% confessed an addiction to pornography. There was an awkward silence in the van, and then I asked, I said, well, what was the solution? And he had no answer. But I thought today you gave us a way forward by inviting us to think about what's the vision of a good life? What does it mean to be made male and female in the image of God and then celebrate that in marriage? If that's presented, maybe that's the way forward instead of, you know, putting blocks on a computer or something. I also appreciated very much your insistence that as we think about human existence, we do so by focusing on the self-revelation of God in Jesus Christ. That it's not simply about who I am or privileging the self without seeing that self in the mirror of Christ, being drawn ever more glory to glory, imitating Christ, and even, as Paul will say to the Ephesians, imitating God as God forgives us. I think that's what Paul is talking about there, and how important that is. So I was thinking of Irenaeus and his famous story of the mosaic, where you have this gorgeous mosaic that Scripture presents, and that the ancient Gnostics chipped away at the glass pieces, right? And then they rearranged them, not in a gorgeous picture of the king, but in a fox or some animal of their own choosing. So I really appreciated how, as we think about human flourishing, we always come back to this imitation of Christ that will ground us as we think about who we are really to be and where we are to go.
You're also always welcome back to my Pentecostal church as well. so many homes.
Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus.
We have an ethos of hospitality here.
Three things came to mind that I think were really wonderful in what you presented. Years ago, Thomas Oden, as he put out his magisterial work, said that my aim is not to be original but faithful. And yet, in his faithfulness, he gave to the world some very original, important historical theology, ecumenical theology. Two crises that you brought to us, I just like to put the categories out for our discussion. And I've been working on these, so I'm thrilled to meet you and to encounter this. But we are in an anthropological and epistemological crisis in our age of what it means to be human and what it means to know anything in a serious way. We have more access to data, but that's not knowledge or wisdom. We have people redefining human essence. And interestingly enough, you can't answer those on their own. And this is why in your presentation it was so powerful, because both said and unsaid is that without both the transcendent reference point and the imminence of incarnation, we can't answer those deepest needs that we have And so I appreciate the resource that you are and you've brought today in this. And as we go about our vocations of, the best way I could, I'm going to use the word discipleship in every, in the broadest sense of making disciples, both in general and in our vocations, I think having a rich Trinitarian and historical theology is essential to discover what it is to be human and what it is to know and be known. So I want to thank you for that contribution.
Thank you. Thank you. We have a queue of questions accumulating, so thank you for submitting those. Please feel free to continue logging on and submitting questions, and also cast some thumbs up votes on the ones that you want us to answer, because I'm definitely going to be looking at those when we go to take the questions. I want to begin with something that Miroslav said at the end of his talk, and that is that theology, if we take seriously this idea that theology has to inform our idea of human flourishing, theology has to speak to public structures, has to speak to the way politics is done, has to speak to the way economics is done. And just to amplify that a bit, if the problem is that we have privatized the good, and we cannot solve that problem by only speaking to individuals about their individual lives, because then we're merely reproducing the privatization of the good. And if you look at, I joked around about this earlier, but if you look at the contrast between the evangelical Dr. Phil and the progressive Noam Chomsky, one of those is speaking to public structures. So the question I want to ask is, since evangelicals are actually historically somewhat notorious for speaking perhaps too much about public life, and yet in the last generation, evangelical theology, as opposed to public voices, evangelical theology actually seems to speak less about public structures. Why do you think that is, and are there first steps we can take to reconnect our theology to public questions in a way that's appropriate?
No, I think it's a hugely important question. It's how does one think of our great institution in the light of truly human purposes? How do these institutions become various institutions become both sites of flourishing and instruments of flourishing? Those are absolutely fundamental question. I think political question these days is a fundamental one. I think economic questions remain abidingly are important and fundamental. I think in our other spheres, I'm thinking in terms of technology and technological developments. Increasingly, I've been interested in kind of the push toward post-humanist ways, but that push is, so to speak, a stream of which one extreme formulation is a post-humanism, but which is embedded in the wider cultural trends in which we find ourselves. So if you ask me why am I not speaking, for instance, myself, or why theologians aren't speaking, well, sometimes I think, well, we theologians aren't the best qualified to speak, partly, right? Because the systems are very complex. I think I've come to appreciate the importance of what Reformed tradition has called the Christian learning, which isn't so much theological, but draws on the resources of theology to articulate a vision of something for which theologians, what theologians, have no expertise or have limited expertise. I think that's what we need as well, kind of interdisciplinary, hard interdisciplinary work. But that work is really hard. It's hard sometimes for theologians, various theological disciplines, somebody steeped in their own silos to talk to each other in a productive way, let alone once you start bridging. I came recently from a conference at Harvard organized by Templeton Foundation on flourishing, with sociological, religious kind of phenomenology, psychology, and theology part of it. I'm not sure that we didn't talk past each other, that we kind of see what the lens through which we are looking allows us to see. And so my sense would be the challenge, especially for those of you who live at Christian universities, work at Christian universities, try to figure out how you can engage in truly interdisciplinary work, which would be very, very important. And some of it is, I think we live in times of very large systems, and the change is incredibly difficult. That's my impression, maybe from outside. From inside might look differently, but on the other hand, when I talk to people who are inside, that's what they tell me. They're kind of prisoners that can do a little bit of pushing, but not radical change.
Definitely. Are the other panelists want to speak on this challenge?
I think what the point you imply and have said specifically is the hyper-specialization of both research and academic disciplines can militate against that kind of conversation, but in Christian communities, Christian universities, churches, institutes, I think we have an opportunity that other institutions may not have, and that's the hard work that you described. And my joke to my students is I could get none of my old jobs back just in my lifetime, the specialization. So I've taught in 4 different disciplines, 60 different courses, and now if I were applying for a job at any of the institutions here, I would be in one department teaching a specific set of classes. I'm not saying that should change, because I think our students are better served than I served them 30 years ago. At the same time, the interaction and the possibility of creating that vision has been lost.
Yeah, I sometimes think that students aren't being served as well. I can afford maybe to exegete your politeness. Sorry, maybe I'm a thick-headed Croatian who doesn't quite get the thing, but. I think of somebody like Karl Barth, even when he was teaching. They were teaching a first number of disciplines with no problem at the university setting, but what they were able to articulate is then the unity. Right now, who adds up to my students? Who adds things together so that what Old Testament, what New Testament folks, what church historians, what ministerial arts, what moral philosophers, what others are telling me, how's it become a unity? And yet you stand on the pulpit, what are you going to speak one Sunday from Old Testament and just do the Old Testament thing and not relate it to human life, but describe what was, and so forth. You're going to preach the disciplines, you have to preach the unity of the word, right? To the unity of their life. And in that sense, I think it becomes a challenge, the splintering of disciplines.
Before we move on too quickly, do the other panelists want to come in on this subject?
Well, I do think the over-specialization is huge, but one of the things I most appreciate about what you were saying and what Lynn brought up is you're reminding us to be theologians. That is, the flourishing life needs to be centered concretely on the person and work of Christ. And it is interesting how easy that is for us to forget. But that is what we bring, right? That is, and so I leave tomorrow and go to a Templeton thing too with a group of psychologists. And I know I've been learning, but I don't know hardly anything about psychology. But we're there to talk about grace. And they're going to try and empirically study grace, which is an interesting phenomenon. But anyways, which is actually, there's a lot to be learned as a theologian in that I learn a ton. And part of what's great is when theologians aren't with psychologists, I think I know what psychology is and I say it. But when I'm with them, they say, well, that's stupid, right? And here's why. And so I need them, but they need me as long as I don't forget what you've said. Be unapologetic about, and the language of, as you know better than I do, the language of flourishment is taken off everywhere. And it's definitely not necessarily connected to Christianity or the triune God. And so we have to be sure that we are constantly going back to that. And if we lose our nerve on that, then we're just not good at whatever else we're doing. So,
amen to that point. Well, the subject of interdisciplinary integration between theological disciplines and the other disciplines of the liberal arts and professional schools brings me to my most provocative question. The specter of the medieval university has haunted us explicitly several times during these presentations. The phrase "queen of the sciences" has been evoked, and the medieval distinctions of the sciences. The Middle Ages really was the last time when there was a sense of the unity of knowledge. The university got the name university from the idea that knowledge was unified. And the understanding of the time was that theology was kind of the keystone in the arch that gave you the possibility of unifying the disciplines. So my highly explosive question is, if the job of theology is to articulate what a good life, what a flourishing human life is, does this imply that theology really is the rightful queen of the sciences?
Anybody wants to answer that?
I'm equally open to any answer here.
Well, if you define science the way, Miroslav, you did, then I think we shortchange theology. But if we can bring back the belief that metaphysical truth really is actual truth, then I think maybe it would make sense for people to think about theology as a queen, because it is bringing together all those bits of knowledge into a coherent whole, a mosaic that makes sense of their life, which involves joys but also sufferings. It has lots of pleasure, but it has pain, and we often remember the pain and the suffering more, and we fear that more. And theology has a lot to say to those sorts of questions that science can't process.
Perhaps a constitutional monarchy with a Bill of Rights.
No, I'm going for queen. I like queen.
Well, I think theology is about human purposes, and it makes truth claims about human purposes. Whether it can be queen of sciences, it's stunning to me how incredibly fast growing the human knowledge is, right? That the studies, so you have this, how often does the knowledge double, right? And I think by 2020, every 13 hours. It's going to be doubling, and it's exponentially growing, right? And then there's language or knowledge obsolescence, the half-life of facts, the book, which is to say it's not just that you're getting new knowledge, but that some of what you think you know, it's not additive. You actually don't know that, so there is a difficulty of kind of inertia of thinking that you know what you actually do not know. So then to think in terms of somebody being a queen of that, and theology being a queen, a king, whatever you want to call, that strikes me almost as impossible. It has a tremendous implication, which I don't know how to think about, in terms of, because it's not just it's increase in knowledge and increase often in instrumental reason, which means technological prowess, which is also exponentially growing, and that's what the whole predictions of Ray Kurzweil, are predicated, just on this exponential kind of growth. So I have no idea how to think about theology as a science, as a queen of sciences. I have a way to think about a theology articulating that which lays claim upon our lives and the one who lays claim upon our lives, however it ends up working itself out in terms of possibility of having anything like a strict unity of the entirety of knowledge, whether we can come up with the theory of everything and with theology at the foundation of it, I'm doubtful.
So perhaps theology takes a seat in Parliament in the Republic of Sciences. We're going to move now to the questions from our colleagues. Can we put them on the screen? Thank you. I'm going to go straight to this question because I think you named this in your talk. This is the elephant in the room. In framing the theological task in terms of the good life, are we, on the surface at least, losing an important theocentric focus? For example, Westminster Confession, question number one, which is, of course, what is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. So I'll throw that grenade out for the group. Are we losing a theocentric focus if articulating the good life for human beings is the theological task?
Well, I think the phrase good life, flourishing life, is a phrase that can find agreement across varieties of both theological Christian and also non-Christian accounts. I think Christians will have their own account of the good life. Maybe the phrase the good life is not the best suited for the Christian tradition. Maybe the phrase flourishing life isn't the best suited for the Christian tradition specifically. Maybe we need something like the true life. Maybe life abundant, I don't know. Somebody mentioned that in some gospel. maybe life that's truly, whatever, right? That might be. But once you put it this way, this is clearly a formal naming something formally, right? But substantively, then you have to fill it out. And without God being at the beginning, at the end, and in the middle of the entirety of thing, without you being able to say that everything is from God and through God and to God, you haven't articulated Christian vision of the good life. You've articulated something that maybe looks like it, but it isn't. So I would want to say, yes, we've got to fill it in theocentric kind of a way.
I think there's a couple resources that help us do this. I'm thinking of Jeffrey Wainwright's great work, Doxology, Understanding Theology as Worship. And then I think of both C.S. Lewis's and N.T. Wright's apologetics are rooted in the common human experience that they then link what Wright calls echoes of a voice and Lewis calls the ought that is beyond ourselves. So I really love the question because it's precisely articulating a visio dei, a vision of the divine dance and a vision of the divine delight in creating humankind that allows words like abundance, flourishing, prosperity, true and good to have a context and relational meaning that wouldn't otherwise be there. But I think worship, I really appreciate, and others have followed in his wake, but I think not disconnecting theology from liturgy and from worship, both worship in the gathered and scattered sense.
Others?
It's going to be provocative now.
Go ahead.
Well, I was always puzzled why in the vision in Revelation there is no temple. Because I take it, because the entirety of the New Jerusalem is not just the temple, but the New Jerusalem is the Holy of Holies of the temple. That's what that's what those dimensions suggest. Which is to say, this is a vision of God dwelling among God's people, which is to say, this is a replication of, or this is the realization of the promise of incarnation with God's dwelling, which is the realization of the promise of creation for God to create the home, a dwelling place for God. But that means that the center is not so much, and this is a controversial part, center is not so much God, but the center is the home of God. God present in the creation. And that was the purpose of creation, not purpose of creation, this controversial part, purpose of creation is not God creates and then we move back to God. To the contrary, purpose of creation is dwelling place of God among the creation, which is to say movement is God's into the creation, which is then to say that the purpose of theology and Christian life is realization of this New Jerusalem-like state in which we are indwelled by God and live in the power of the Spirit to God's glory in God's home.
As we move on, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I like the question because I feel it's very honest. We don't know outside of ourselves. And so to imagine that I can know and speak about God without having some sort of skin in the game, even resurrection skin in the game, I think just it's not true. So I think all theology at one level is asking the question, what about me? And I think God's okay with that. And as I participate in Christ's life, as I always will, even in my resurrected state, Lord willing, it will always include me as I know God.
We do remain creatures, after all. And as we move on to the next question, I'll point out the Westminster Confession of Faith, question and answer one. The answer is theocentric, but the question is not theocentric, it's anthropocentric. And the question, what is the chief end of man, could even be rendered as what is the flourishing life for human beings? It's very similar. All right, we do have to move on. I want to ask, in a society that demands that knowledge must be useful, we talked about instrumental reason a moment ago. In a society that demands knowledge must be useful, how should a theology devoted to human flourishing make sure it is not reduced to usefulness?
You have to start by eliminating the false dichotomy between theory and practice, between knowing for its own beauty and the immediate volitional activity that someone might engage in. We've created a false dichotomy of those things. I don't want to take too much time away from anyone else, but my wife spent one evening sharing with professionals about art and beauty. And their answer was, what a waste of time and money, that could all go to missions. And these were lawyers, doctors, professionals who felt that it was a waste of time. My wife came home in tears as an artist, and I sent her back saying, ask them what's on the walls of their home. And at the end of the second discussion, something happened, and the Holy Spirit helped her and helped her partner, but something happened to create a value for beauty that had not been thought of or at least articulated by that group. I use that because I love the question, but I think we have fragmented the disciplines. I want to get rid of practical theology departments. Frankly, I want to get rid of...
Not the professors, not the faculty, just the departmental distinction.
But when we say theology and practical theology, we're just reinforcing these kinds of dichotomies that we have.
This is tricky because we have to be a little careful here, because right now it'd be easy for us, and if you know any of my writing, I'm all about practical theology. I'm a systematic historical theologian, but I write primarily for the laity in the church, because when I write with Brill, it's 400 copies. Ain't nobody reading it. Nobody. So having said that, it can be easy then, and you weren't doing this, but it can be easy to then dismiss the need for careful theology. And the reality is, debate, say, like on the impassibility of God, wherever you're at on that issue, when you talk about that up front with someone, that just sounds absurd and abstruse and totally unuseful. But no matter where you end up on that, it's profoundly practical. But you have to do a lot of careful work to get there. And the problem is, if we don't have people do the careful work, and it's all just downstream, that works for a generation or two, but then there are consequences. So that feels weird for me to argue, because I'm all about, like, I think we as academic theologians have made ourselves irrelevant. So I do think, but I don't love the word useful. I like the word practical, as long as it's rightly understood in terms of the tradition. But part of the vocation is, there are different ways this God calls you into this, right? And we do believe, you know, classically, all Christians are theologians, as Martin Luther said. But there are different kinds of theologians, different callings. What I appreciate is you're saying the majority of academic theologians have become fairly, we're at risk of becoming irrelevant or not. And so you're calling us to that. But in this setting, it is worth us still saying, hey, if you're a specialist, that can be good work, but don't forget who you serve in a broader community and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would say useful for what, right? And so usefulness, I take it, knowledge is useful. Even the reflection on the true life is a kind of useful form of useful knowledge. And I want to echo what you've just said. And in fact, in the book, For the Life of the World, we have a half a page small print footnote defending the interest in the question of how many angels can dance on a single pin. Yeah. That's not necessarily excluded in the kind of concern that we have. So,
very good, very good. All right, last question, and I've saved this for last because it is, I think, a practical way to end. And I'd like to ask each of our panelists to briefly share something, and having unfairly put you on the hot seat, I'll start with Charlie and come the other way this time. What curricular changes in theological education do you suggest to resist disciplinary fragmentation? So it's, as you said, it's very easy to complain about the status quo, but to offer a constructive alternative is harder. So what can we practically do as first steps to resist the fragmentation of the disciplines?
Four things come to mind. First of all,
I only get one.
how quickly can you speak?
First of all, to have the institution, department, whatever group has decision-making power, to have a real common vision of outcomes, to really understand the aims you have for your students intellectually, morally, and otherwise. I think a second thing is constant interdisciplinary interaction, both curricular and co-curricular, in the gatherings in classrooms. I bring in guests to my classes, et cetera. That's a practical thing. A third thing that I think is important is bringing practitioners, bringing pastor theologians, just as one example, showing those who do integrate this and modeling this kind of integration. And I think the fourth thing is, I want to come full circle back to Dr. Wolf's address, constantly in an aspirational sense, helping people connect the deepest work they do in a classroom and the work of their hands and feet in service to the world with the most intimate experiences they have personally and corporately in worship. So it becomes this Colossians 3:17 ethos. So that's where I would start.
Okay, you took a lot of great ideas from me, Charlie.
I'm sorry.
That was a compliment.
It was definitely a compliment. Now I just have to think up a couple
more. You're the provost, so you know a lot more.
I was going to say team teaching, which is expensive. I know that now. One of my former colleagues, Vince Baycoat, and I, as a biblical studies and theologian, would teach our senior seminar at Wheaton College, and I learned so much from Vince. And I guess we could, so, and it was a dynamic classroom, so that was very fun. But I think also, as individuals, we can read outside of our discipline and then bring that into our classrooms as well.
I teach a course at Divinity School entitled Christ and Being Human. And it incorporates, in terms of reading materials, Gospels, Old Testament passages. It incorporates theology and in various aspects of being human incorporates other non-theological disciplines. We have a session on food, we have a session on sex, we have a session on death, we have a session on suffering, things like that, right? All in the light of Christ. Now you can then draw, I can then draw from all the disciplines. And we introduce each class. Each class starts with reading a kind of almost like a spiritual reading of a assigned gospel text with a five-minute meditation about the personal impact of that text upon a life of a person. And then we enter in our discussion. So we incorporate the kind of spiritual exercise into it, as well as reading from wide variety of disciplines. And then I have students do often practical kinds of assignments with that, with material that they kind of have read or they have discussed in the class.
That's good. Two things. The first is very practical. And maybe you guys are all godly, and this never happens at your institutions. It doesn't happen a lot at ours, but I know it happens all over the place within our disciplines, is that we undermine one another in the classroom. So theologians can talk about biblicists, and New Testament scholars act like theologians don't read the Bible, and churches, and we all do it, and sometimes it's good-humored, and sometimes it's not. That communicates something to students. And then depending on which personality is most charismatic, they go with them. And this is a big problem. And I think it's very important, even when I might have personal disagreements or personality issues with the faculty, when I'm in front of students, pretty much the only time I think it's permissible or appropriate for me to bring up a faculty member is to praise them and bring up something of quality from their work. And I think that may seem small, but I think it communicates a lot. So I would just start at that level. And then the other thing I would just say is I do buy into the fact that we're worshiping creatures. And every loci, every theological thing I'm talking about, including being human, all that, that discipline of trying to say, if I've got an hour and 15-minute class, I don't want to do it cheaply. And you all know what it is to do it cheaply. And so I don't want to make it artificial and say it has to be every class. But it has to be a regular part where the students leave thinking, I have seen the beauty of God, or I have encountered truth. And when that happens, it doesn't matter if they're studying psychology or history or whatever, they're still going to study it, but they realize theology matters to their life. It matters when they're changing their diaper, not their diapers, well, maybe those two, but...
it'll come.
I know. I'll stop there.
Amen. Well, amen to those. And additionally, in my program, one thing I noticed is a sign of good, healthy collegiality across the disciplines is the professors in one department were asking the students what they were studying and what they had learned about X in the classes in the other department when an appropriate topic came up. So in a systematics class, the professor would say, now in your New Testament class, have you studied X and what have they told you? So that I can now deconstruct it, but so that we can look for connections. And I found that really helpful. Would you please help me in join me in thanking our panelists for this outstanding presentation. Thank you so much. Breakfast tomorrow is in the Landmark restaurant down on the other end of the hotel. And those of you who are at the retreat, shuttles begin running at 8, so please be prompt. Thank you very much and enjoy your evening.
it's a new horizon. I'm set on you, and you meet me here today with mercies that are new. All my fears and doubts, they can all come to, because they can't stay long when I'm here with you. It's a new horizon, and I'm set on you.
Try to fit you in the walls inside my mind. I try to keep you safely in between the lines. I try to put you in the box that I've designed. I try to pull you down so we are eye to eye. When did I forget that you've always been the king of the world? I try to take life back right out of the hands of the king of the world. How could I make you so small when you're the one who holds it all? When did I forget that you've always been the king of the world? Still I run ahead and think I'm strong enough, when you're the one who made me from that dust. When did I forget that you've always been the king of the world? I try to